I guess it's time to get serious now. And so I'll introduce John C.
My name is John, and I'm an alcoholic. This program is a program of attraction rather than promotion, and damn, I sure wished I was out there promoting. You people are a physical demonstration that of some of us that are willing to go to any lengths. Any lengths. You know, when I came into the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a lot of things going for me, and a great deal of it was hate and anger and resentment, and the basic feeling that I was trying so hard all of my life to be good and to do the right things, and wound up getting screwed because of it. A couple times I've had the feeling while I was in a meeting, because of the feelings that I've had, when I came into the fellowship, I had no God. I didn't believe in this thing. If there was one, somebody that I was going to deal with when I died, and since I tried so hard, I'm sure that he would give me a fair hearing. But the feeling was, why is it that you work so hard and do so many things to do the right thing, and you wind up getting screwed? And I've been thinking many times of, I could have perhaps introduced myself before I started and recognized that I was an alcoholic. I might possibly have introduced myself in my first meeting as, my name is God and I'm a John. And I thought of that one too. But that's really it. Really. I was used and I was abused and I tried so hard and you people weren't treating me right. God knows I didn't want things to happen the way they did. You know, the feeling of always looking around for something and not knowing what it was that you wanted and knowing damn well what you had wasn't it. That was my bag. I came into the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and deep down inside my gut, but I knew full well that there wasn't anything left. The world that I had envisioned somewhere in my early years was not the world that I lived in. And I used the phrase that the world was a shitty place and everybody in it was a bastard. And that's true. It was true for me. The only good person I've met a few good people in my life. I married two of them. And one of them was my mother. Met a lot of other people that weren't so very nice. But I certainly had given up on me and I'd given up on the human race. And I don't know how that happened. It happened over a long period of time, I guess. You know, I don't know really how I can express what it is that I'm trying to say. That you look out, my wife has put the words in my mouth once, and she says that I looked out one time and saw the world was bright and shiny, and it should be. And over the passage of time, that the lights dimmed. And it got dirty and tarnished. And what the hell was the use of living in this crappy old world? I was born into a place that should have been right, and it wasn't. And then I come to realize that I didn't really want to be born into this damn place. You had to spend all of your life doing things you didn't like to do, trying so hard to make people respond the way they should so that everybody would be happy, and it didn't happen that way. Going back to some of the very earliest feelings that I had, the feelings of the concern that things weren't really going right. I remember during the Depression that my father had a homestead down in the Imperial Valley. And even in those days, I was a very quiet little boy. Tried to be studious and tried to mind and do all of the right things. And I remember getting out of the first grade and the teacher telling me, here, and I was called Jackie. Oh, God, I hate the name. I was called Jackie. And she said, Jackie, here's a book, because they probably don't have anywhere you're going. Because we were going out in the wilds of the Imperial Valley long before there was any Imperial Valley. There was nothing but dust and sand and no water. And I lived there for many number of years. I came back. I was born and raised in Southern California. And my dad used to tell me so many, many times, and I guess this is perhaps where I got the idea, I don't know, that I was born not in the ring, but at the same time that Jack Dempsey and Eugene Tunney fought. And thank God it was their second fight, because I was going to be named Jack Dempsey. it was, fortunately for me, it was the night of the long count, and my dad compromised, and he named me Jack Jean, because Eugene Tunney beat. I guess it's the first evidence that the goddamn world isn't paying attention to the way it's supposed to be, because my birth certificate came out as John Eugene. Because Jack wasn't a name when the lady who filled it out. And I didn't know that until I went into the army, that suddenly my name became John. But my dad was an alcoholic, just like me. Or I was an alcoholic just like him. And it's so funny. People comment about the environment. I didn't know that my dad was an alcoholic. I know he drank. I didn't think there was anything unusual about our household. The fact that my dad drank was no big deal. And when he fought, or when he drank, he fought. And invariably, he fought with us. And I didn't think that was any big deal. We all piled in to help my mother, because he always fought with her and he called her some very bad names. And that was totally out of context with the man. You know, he was such a quiet, reserved fellow during the weeks and the months that he was sober. But when he drank, he turned violent. And I knew I was never going to be like that. And I think it's so funny, because his pattern was periodic and so was mine. The only basic difference was he drank beer and I drank bourbon. He got drunk and he stayed drunk for months on end and stayed sober for years on end. And I didn't do that. I stayed sober for weeks or months. And then I drank for whatever length of time it was that I drank. I know full well that I never made any great glaring decision that I wasn't going to drink like my dad, but I knew I didn't want to be like him. I didn't want to be like him because I wanted to know him so desperately, and I couldn't, because he was early to work and early home and always to bed. And I wanted to know what the man looked like and what he felt like inside, and I couldn't do that. Because he was closed, just like I turned out to be, too. He didn't know how to share. I say that this program is one where we are people who have to share their experience, strength, and hope, and that's what the program is designed for, but we don't know how to share when we come in here. We're taught to conceal and to lie and to evade, and oh, God, don't let anybody see what kind of a person we are. Because, oh, the old John syndrome steps in, and they're going to screw you. I was gifted in many areas of my life, and not all of them were intellectual. I was given a fine body and a tremendous sense of coordination, and athletically inclined. I was an outstanding fighter. I had, like my father, I had a violent temper. I went in the service and I had alcohol for the very first time in my life. and at that particular time. Most assuredly, my thinking pattern was the same as it is now, basically. All I needed was the physical allergy to manifest itself the day I was an alcoholic. And then when I drank my first time out, I drank the only way I knew how to, and I hadn't changed. I drank all the way, as much as I could get down, as long as I could drink. That's the way I drank. I did a lot of fighting. I led a pretty violent life for a long period of time, at least in those early years. I fought in the ring, and I did do a lot of fighting in the streets. I had a gang of people that I never led them, but they used to call upon me whenever there was any action going because I was a good guy. Even then, I was standing back, never joining in, but always standing in back because I was the heavyweight, you know. When they needed some backup, they needed any protection, that was my bag. Because I know only one way to fight, and that was to go for the throat. That's the only way I've ever fought. You know, it's, we're people of excesses. You know, if it's worth doing, it's worth doing to excess. I never knew how to fight a little bit. I never knew how to love a little bit. And I certainly didn't know how to hate a little bit. It's worth doing, by God, it's do it right. And I certainly never got a little bit drunk. I either did or I didn't. One of those old adages that I had was there's nothing in the world more useless than one drink, unless it's two. I've stayed away from many a place where the idiots would pour one drink and they expect that that's all that anybody would have. One of the lady that I married, one of those people that, honest to God, you could pour her a drink and she'd sit there and let it evaporate. And I didn't. But fortunately, I always came to her rescue. I married my high school sweetheart before she graduated. And that was a big, serious concern to her. We had a little baby. And I was relatively very young. And the doctor gave me the baby. And I held that little baby in my hands. And I looked at that thing and I said, this little girl is precious to me. And oh God, I'm going to be a good father. I'm going to take care of this little baby. And I'm going to take care of this little girl that I'm married to. But then when you look at my life, the life that I was leading, it had far too much violence in it. I had a temper that was scaring me, and I was so goddamn good. Now, I say that for hindsight, and should please don't anybody challenge me today because it's gone from me. I just got some records and some mementos of things that I don't have to do anymore. I don't know if any of you have ever fought or if you ever had in a big high school game or a college game or whatever, but if you know the gut feeling that comes upon you before the action starts, and maybe, just maybe you're one of those like me, that it was so intense that probably you had to vomit a little bit, and you were shaken, well, that was nothing. That was nothing compared to what it was like when the fight was over. Because I fought a lot of times, and I've hurt a lot of people, and some of them very seriously. You know, God, you know, if you lose your head, and I did that, and you get mad, and I did that, and you perhaps go into what I call a rage blackout, and I've done that, and you kind of come out of it, you see somebody down there, and there's a lot of blood laying around, and you know that you've hurt somebody pretty bad, and you didn't want to do that. You know, oh, I'll tell you, the feelings that you have before a football game, or before a track meet, or before the ring, in the ring, are nothing compared to those. Absolute, total disgust. Because you know you didn't have to do it. Up to, including when I came into my first meeting, I had a belief. And the belief was I'd never met a man I couldn't whip. And, baby, I'm not that big. But I had a hatred big enough to take care of all the size lacked. This is an interesting disease, and the longer you get sober, the more you find about the wreckage of your past. You know, I looked at my life at that particular point in time and realized that I was going nowhere with it and I better change it. And I took the action that I had. The only thing I recognized, I could no longer live the life I was living in order to raise my little girl and to be a good father. And so I did the only thing I could. I changed me with all the tools that I had available at the time. And all the tools I had available at the time was I took a little bit of that and a little bit of that, and I don't want any of that. And I took all of the stuff that I had working for me that was no good, and I stuffed it down because I had to make those decisions. I had no tools other than the ones I brought with me. And they weren't all that good, but they are the only things I had. And so I did what any good self-respecting alcoholic would do. I stuffed. And I became an entirely different human being outside. I still had this rage, and I still had the anger, and I still drank. But I became a businessman. I don't know, I'm not going to regale you with the glorious good old days. But those good old days, my God. Like going out with your wife. You haven't gone out for weeks. And you go and have a good time and maybe have a few drinks. And then you don't know. You don't know what happened. You don't know whether it was that old blind rage that creeps in. I remember once, just like this, had a good night, had a nice time. I had a few drinks, because that's all I ever had was just a few. You know, as long as I could remember them, there was just a few. Only had a couple. But we're walking down the street, and a couple guys, this was in downtown Los Angeles, and on the neatest place in downtown L.A., and a couple guys got smart. And the next thing I knew, that there they were laying on the floor, or on the sidewalk, and one of them was very critically injured. And I don't know to this day whether it was blind rage or a blackout, one of those little blinky in-ears outs. But he went to the hospital, and whether he's alive today, I have no idea. Because I just really thought that that was the macho thing to do, obviously. If anybody gets smart with your lady, you do what you have to do. But by the same token, when you look in down there and you see all of these glorious things that you're able to do, and you see one person that can't breathe anymore because you've managed to just virtually destroy his throat, it makes you wonder. But you have to stuff it down a little bit longer. And you think back of the good old days of stopping in and having a couple of drinks. I still don't know this story. It's mine and I don't know it. I had a business deal that fell through one evening in Compton. And I stopped and had a couple of drinks because times were bad and I didn't have any money and I needed the deal. And the next thing I know, I'm in the parking lot after having a couple. And there's a policeman and he says, "Freeze." And I get to go to jail for armed robbery. And I don't know whether I ever did that. I know that I went through all the rigmarole and I went through the lineup and I know they left me go. But I don't know to this day whether I did that or not. You see, there's a little piece of my life missing. And they may still be looking for me, I don't know. But there was a period of time while I was in that bar that somebody went in and robbed a liquor store and shot it up a little bit. Now, I don't know where I was going. I didn't have any guns with me. At least they didn't find any, and I don't remember. But what a glorious thing to start talking about. Go home and explain to your wife how accidentally you were gone for a day and a half and the reason you were gone for a day and a half is it was a case of mistaken identity. So I didn't do anything wrong. My God, I'm not that kind of a person. Well, am I, because I've got this rage, and I've got this anger, and I got the hate. And I know that we lived in many... We had good times, and we had bad times. But in the process of me growing up and my lovely wife growing up, we had four other little girls. And then it came a point in time when I was getting more and more successful and making a lot of money, quite a bit of money. And I was set up to be opening a branch office in another state. And the little girl that I was married to was grievously concerned about this thing. Because, of course, when you're in the type of business I'm in, and I love every person who comes into the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous basically tells you the same thing. Now, the business that I'm in, everybody drinks. Now, I don't care what it is. We come from a field where everybody drinks. And everybody drank. I was in construction. And everybody drank in construction. And I closed many and many a big deal over six martinis. Comment about one of the biggest deals I ever wrote in my life was after I'd lost it. After I'd lost it, and it's 5 o'clock, and a guy says, well, too bad, but it's 5 o'clock, and I'm done talking business, and he reached in his drawer and pulled out my brand. It was called bourbon. And he says, I would like to have a drink. Would you care? Have one. I said, certainly. He says, well, I don't take any thing in it. I have nothing to mix. And I said, Christ, I don't know how to drink it any other way. Before the bottle was over, I had his name on the contract. And I bragged about that. And when there's a justification for all the drinking that I've done. A lot of parties and a lot of doings going on. And the little girl that I was married didn't understand these things. She never graduated from high school. She had five little girls. She was home all the time. And I had turned into a big wheel. And it scared her. It scared her, and she talked to me several times. Interestingly enough, there was no problems relative to alcohol. She was concerned about the times out that I went, the places I had to go. But all my drinking was done outside. I didn't drink any at home. Alcohol was in the background, but it was never in the forefront. And she said that she was concerned about what was happening in her life. She was wondering when it was going to end, and I told her that she didn't quite understand the problems out there. You know, you've got to do certain things. And if we want to get this big promotion, I've got to continue to do these things. And I had to continually assure her that I loved her. And I did, with all that I had at the time. And since it's part of my story, I have to tell it, because this is the way it happened. I was out of town on a so-called business deal, which was no deal at all. We had had an argument. We were set to go out of town. We had problems with the in-laws, and I said, by God, I'm going. If you care to join me, I will be pleased to have you. So I took off, and it's the first time that I know of in my whole life that I've ever argued with my wife. And I would like to say, and I believe I honestly can, that it was the last time, too. Because when I was out of town, I got a phone call. And it was from my very best friend. And he says that your wife has committed suicide. The feelings you're familiar with. You know what it's like to have your guts laid out there on the floor. And you scream into yourself inside because you can't let it out. Why me? There's brief periods of time that I can remember. Because I flipped out on that one. I remember vaguely waking up and they were sewn on my hand. As I was in the psychiatric wing of the Los Angeles General Hospital and they were talking about this Raven Lunian that they had brought in. The doctor says, I'm going to take the jacket off so I can sew him up. And the man says, you're crazy. He'll kill you. It took him 8 people to put him in there. He destroyed an apartment building doing that. And the doctor says, I'm going to let him loose anyway. I was so grateful for that. That I remember. Then I remember a little later on, laying someplace. And I had figured out that if I handled myself just right, I could unbuckle this thing that I was in. And I got so goddamn tired trying to do that. That I remember in a room, trying to sleep, because I was so tired and so sick and I wanted to forget all these things. I remember the funny little window that they used to slide and peek at you. They used to upset me. But the recovery, the ability of an alcoholic to recover, is rather phenomenal. Now, we all like to think of outside influences. Well, first of all, let me tell you, it was in July. It was hotter than hell. And it was a full moon. And those of us who were incarcerated in this place were heard from those in charge about how serious it was this time of the year when it was so unbelievably hot and in the full moon. They were horribly understaffed. They didn't have enough security in here. And they would lock us up at night and they would only have one. I don't even know what his name was or what his position was, but there was only one guy in charge. And he had to lock himself in because he didn't dare walk out. But the guys were flipping off left and right. They'd call in 4 or 5 people and they'd put them down and they'd strap them and then they'd haul them away to Camarillo State Hospital. There was a fellow by the name of Joe DeBrasini, bless his heart. He said, John, if we want to get out of this place, we'll help them. So for 2 days, while I had one arm strapped behind me, he and I were patrolling the halls and taking care of the drunk, or not the drunks, we're taking care of the loonies, because we weren't that way at all. Talked to a psychiatrist, good old psychiatrist was telling me all the things that were wrong with me, and I knew full well, my God, I had to get out of this place. I've got 5 little girls there, and 2 of them are in diapers, and 1 of them is only a few weeks old. And I've got to get out, because the only person in the world that can take care of them is me. Because nobody loves them or cares for them like I do, and I've got to get out. They told me what I had to do, and I'm talking to this absolute idiot. The psychiatrist. He's telling me what I'm supposed to think and how I'm supposed to react. And that was acceptable to me in order to get out. I know that one day I'd go in there and he would tell me all of the psychiatric care. I was going to go to Camarillo State Hospital, but because of my actions within the confines of our little rooms at they felt that I was turning into a responsible human being, and they're going to keep me here longer to find out if I can get weller. Then they took the straitjacket off, and he said to me, John, he says, we'll let you out, but of course you're going to have years of psychiatric care. But being the kind of people we are, the next day, I got discharged without further need of psychiatric care. You see, they had turned me loose to attend the funeral on parole, and I had come back. And I apparently had done all the things that I was supposed to have done because it was acceptable that I should return and do and say the things that I had to say. Anything was necessary to get out. But, of course, I had a lot of problems when I got out. They had sent word to me while I was in the hospital that they didn't need me at my place of employment anymore because I had projected the wrong image. Deciding that the real problem was Southern California, I moved to Northern California and got a job and became the best father and the best mother I knew how to be. But when you get into a place like I had been into, and you look and see that everything you've ever tried to do in your whole life has been screwed up, and that you haven't done the right thing, and the thing that you tried so goddamn hard to do, to be a good father of those children and a good husband for that little lady, and you managed to destroy it, then you got to know there's not a hell of a lot you can do other than try and fix you, which is exactly what I did. I did the same thing I'd done once before. I analyzed and figured out, well, this is no good, and I'll keep this, and this is no good, and I'll keep this, and I'll fix me, using all the tools I had. And so on top of all the crap that I had, I stuffed more. After passage of time, I met a lovely lady who didn't want to get married, and neither did I. But the odds were great. It was irresistible. She was oversexed. And I had to protect her. She had a boy and a girl in a car and a television. And when you can get to such a buy like that, there's nothing you can do about it. So I... It's only because we got such a small group, honey, I reveal your secrets. When I married her, I had a fine job. I had was a manager of a company in South San Francisco, division manager, making a lot of money, more money than I had ever made before in my life, because I have the ability to recoup and recover. And I'd like to tell you that everything was rosy from there on in, but it wasn't. Every year I made less money for 10, 12 years. We went up and down the state of California. I hated Southern California. I wound up back there, going, getting promoted and demoted, and promoted and fired. Nobody. Just because at one time I got drunk, went back and told the general manager he was fired. Fired the 14 guys I had working for me. But nobody ever said I had any problem with alcohol, nor did I believe that, if they had mentioned it. We finally wound up in Fresno. Oh, God, Fresno. What a beautiful town. I invested heavily in the economy of Fresno. And I went bankrupt in Fresno. But to show you, we got a feeling of impending doom in this outfit. And I want you to know it's justified. It was for me. Because everything has gone to hell. And I've lost everything I have. But my wife says she's pregnant. That's no big deal. Except I haven't been sterilized and she's medically incapable of conceiving. And that's something to drink about. At least that's the way I thought about it. And I did. I drank about it. And I drank about it. And then I got to thinking and I realized the problem. And I knew what the solution of the problem was. And it was Fresno. So I left Fresno. And We come to the great Northland, back home. Still making less money. Oh, the good old days. We hit San Jose, and I didn't have any money. And I was walking from where I live in Los Gatos. Survivors, oh God, how we could do it. I had a job in San Francisco, but I didn't have any money. Now, I lived in Los Gatos, and I walked and thumbed to the train depot to take a train to San Francisco so I could take a bus so I could walk to work. Now, I left at, God, 5 o'clock and got home at 9. And it was all right, man. Because you could have a few drinks. You always have a few drinks while you're waiting for the train. And you could always sleep it off on the way home. There was nothing wrong with that. Then I was offered a bribe by a company in San Jose. And I didn't accept the bribe, but I accepted the job. And I came to work here in San Jose. And the trade that is still mine today, but not the same company. Things started getting better. Things started getting very better. And this is, we ride this elevator or the roller coaster. And I was taught by a glorious man, and it made sense to me, and it is true, that if there is one thing worse for an alcoholic than bad times, it's good times. Because, baby, that's my cycle, and it has been my cycle all my life. You get down, because down is where I can really let it all go and fight and use every goddamn tool I've got so that I can make it good, so that I can get to destroy it, so I can go right down again and start the whole cycle all over again. And times got good, and that's scary. But this time I came to the decision, I said, Peggy, they ain't going to get me this time. I'm going to do it first. Only alcoholics, I guess. I don't know. I don't know if everybody is as nuts as we are. But I sold my house and bought another one and put $20,000 worth of furniture in it before the other one was sold, and it fell through, and I wound up with two houses and no money. And then the house that we had built was built on an illegal piece of ground, and they couldn't record the loan on it. And I've got all the money invested in it. So I suddenly became, I don't know what you would call it. I became an expert on the art of correcting trust deeds. And I had a big meeting of all the people in the area, and I drew up a deed that permitted me to have legal access to the building we were living in. And they bought it, and it's legal. Now, where I got the knowledge, I can't honestly tell you, but we do whatever is necessary to do. And all the years that I have been married, because that's all my life. Basically, one time and one time only did anyone ever say, you got a problem with alcohol. She said, John, you've got to do something about your drinking. And I said, well, yeah, hon. I realize I went over a little deep that time. I won't do that anymore, but you have to understand what the problems are. And I went on to explain the problems, and I don't know whether she bought that or not. But it never came up again. And my last time out was with a good guy here in the room, and he and I managed to make total asses of ourselves in this lovely city of San Jose. I remember once interrupting whatever we were drinking, and I was interrupting because I had to go to Bruner's Furniture down on Highway 17. And I don't know if you've ever noticed the big sign they have over there. But I was supposed to pick up a bedspread for our new house. And it was ready. And I couldn't find Bruner's. So rather than miss the good times, I went back. I don't even know where we were. And wherever we were, we stayed for a while, and then we went somewhere else. And this time I found Bruner's. And then we wound up at a health spa. And I remember pieces of that. And then the next thing I know, there I was, just as sound asleep as a pretty little baby on my couch. And Peggy woke me up. She said, "Your friend's on the telephone, and I think he needs some help." And that's part of my story, too, because he's the beautiful man who came out of jail, because that's where he was. And in a few days, he came to me and he said, "Hey, John, I found a beautiful place. And I'd like to share it with you. And it's called Alcoholics Anonymous." And I didn't know anything about this fellowship, and I didn't know anything about you. And I knew full well in my own gut that there was no real problem that I couldn't handle, because, God damn it, I'd done it all my life. And if anybody has ever fought their way through the things that I had fought, then there certainly is no problem behind alcohol. And I've known that all of my life. Alcohol was not my problem. And I knew it when I came in, and I know it now. Alcohol was not my problem. It never was. My problem was living without it. And I didn't know how to do that. I honestly didn't know how to do that. He gave me a list of 20 questions, and I read them. And I answered them, and I have a reputation, and I want you to know this because it's important. I have a reputation for honesty in my business that's unparalleled. And I read those 20 questions, and I answered them deep down in my gut as honest as I could. And I missed 2.5. And if you read them, you know they're true and false. And I don't know how you get a halfway true or false, but I got one. Now, last time I read it, I missed 16. That's perhaps, I'd like to think it's because I'm more honest, or not necessarily more honest, but I certainly am in position of being able to see some of the things that I could never see before. It says in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that there are some of us who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. And I don't know what you think about that, but I know what I think about it. That was me. Because if I had been able to see me, I would have fixed me. God damn it, I had tried with all my being twice to do that. And so I was. In true fact, constitutionally incapable of being honest with myself. But it goes on and tells me that even they, too, can recover. Bobby brought me to my first meeting, and I heard it, and I've been using it ever since. It said that night, and you guys have been putting me to sleep with it ever since, that today was the first day of the rest of my life, or that yesterday was gone forever, and tomorrow will never come. Today was the only day you had. And that meant a great deal to me, because I took it home with me, and it put me to sleep. Because I had, when I hit the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, even for a periodic, I had to do an awful lot of drinking in order to get to sleep. And it's been putting me to sleep ever since. You see, I had a past that was so horrible. All of the things that I was trying to fix. I love that Snoopy cartoon. I think it's so neat. I don't know if you guys saw it a couple weeks ago. Little old Snoopy and one of his little, Charlie Brown and one of his friends, little friends, was saying that Charlie, I think maybe I make a mistake because I'm spending so much time worrying about tomorrow. I think I'd pay attention to today. And Charlie said, "Oh, that's quitting. I'm still hoping tomorrow will get better, or yesterday will get better." Yes. And that was me. With all of the being I had, I was trying to fix yesterday, and I couldn't do that. You know, this whole business of being over there in yesterday and here in tomorrow, you never see yourself passing. You're never now. You're always there. And you're a vacuum where you're at. But you guys told me in my first meeting that I'd never have to hurt again as long as I live? If I don't want to. And that meant that you were pointing your fingers at me. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous taught me that selfishness and self-centeredness was my problem. Now, it will come as a surprise, but it still is. Selfishness and self-centeredness is still my problem. But it is not the problem. It is not the size of the problem that it was when I came in here. Because all of the things that I had been trying so desperately to do all of my life have occurred in my life. You see, I got lost in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I spent so much time trying to be something. I wanted so goddamn hard to be a good father. I wanted so desperately to be a good husband. And when I got here, it was apparent that once again I had failed my best efforts, because I was able to see that my wife was contemplating divorce. I was able to see for the first time why my children left home early. I was able to see for the first time why my little boy, the little medical miracle, why he didn't like to be in the same room with me. I was able to see for the first time why I didn't like me. And I was told I couldn't do anything about that. By myself, I could not do anything about that. And looking at my track record, and if you can only know how desperately I tried to fix me, to manage to destroy the only things I really liked, the only things I really cared about, when I'd given it, I thought, my undivided attention. And then you told me I couldn't do anything about that. And the only way I could get sober was to get sober. You worked the 12 steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for the purpose by which the steps were written, for sobriety. And in the process of doing that, some amazing things are going to happen. But I can't work them in order to have the amazing things happen. That may sound a contradiction, but that is exactly what it is all about. I did not get sober to get my wife back because I was told, the program told me that if you are willing to go to any length to get what we have, any length, and what I had was not mine. I had destroyed it. I did not want it back because I didn't know how to get it back. I did not know how to establish a relationship with my wife and with my children and with you and with me. God knows I had tried. I didn't know how to do that. And you told me that I should get sober. And the reason I should get sober was to, not the reason I was supposed to get sober, the purpose of getting sober was to work the steps, and in the process of working the steps, things would happen in your life. So I do not have my wife back. I have the same lady, bless her heart, but she is not the same woman. I do not have a relationship with her that I could have ever envisioned because I didn't know how to do that. If a choice was mine, it would be different because there's no way that I could have projected the feelings, the emotions, the ability to share and care that we have today. It was beyond my ability to foresee or expect this thing. Because, you see, I was sober for 2.5 years and I came up wake in the middle of a meeting and recognized
recognized for the first time in my whole life. I was,
and it was a profound awakening to recognize that I was a good husband.
And a good father. And the only way I got that is because I quit trying to be and let myself become what it is that I am today. Now, that may not be all that good, but it's all I've got. And if you don't like it, it's your fault anyway. You see, if I came in this program and tried to have determined what it was that I was going to be, I sure as hell wouldn't be what I am tonight, because I didn't know how to be this kind of a person. There are many, many things that has happened to me in sobriety, and I cannot talk at all without telling one story at least. You guys have been so very patient and persistent. I know that we got to go roller skating later on. But it is a program of first things first, and God damn it, I'm here. And you're going to look awfully conspicuous when you leave if you're not willing to wait until we all do it at the same time. Gail laid it nasty on me when I came in. She says, this is a bad night to be talking. And I said, well, I'm willing to compete with Jesus Christ. And she said, you mean the Easter Bunny? As part of my sobriety, I have many stories. I have many stories. You see, I was very fortunate because I didn't have a God when I came here. And you told me I had to be willing. And if I wasn't willing, I should learn how to be willing to be willing to be willing to be willing to be willing. And that was me at the beginning. I had the willingness to start. And strange things happened to me. Strange for me, they are no longer strange today. They are what I call the law. They may be strange to you, and it doesn't make any difference. But they started happening to me right from the gate. Funny coincidences that I didn't understand. And I talked to Peggy, and she'd say, oh, these have been happening all along. And I'd say, oh, Christ, you don't understand. I go talk to a drunk. She was awfully sick in those days. Then I had something happened, and I was really serious about this thing, and I asked Peggy, and I said, is this God thing, is this the way things really happen? And she said, yeah. And I said, oh boy, that's neat. That's really neat. And for the first time since I was on a program, I took those prayers that I didn't know how to pray, and I felt very uncomfortable at praying. And I was given bought a 24-hour book because I had to use those things to use as a prayer. And when I started branching out and doing my prayers, you know, I was driving the car down the street, and I had to speak aloud because I didn't want to make sure that no random thoughts got up there. And then I said, oh, Christ, erase that one and start all over again. Oh, it had to be right. It had to be right even when I was talking to God. But for the first time in my sobriety, when I looked at these beautiful things that were happening, and I said to myself, oh, God, this is neat. And I told my God for the first time, in words that even I could understand, hey, this is neat. And I sure appreciate it. And, hey, the next one you got coming down the pike, let me see it. Not only let me see it, let me recognize it. And let me give thanks for it. Now, I don't know if you've ever done that, but I have. and I haven't stopped seeing them. They haven't stopped happening in my life. Oh, I'm so grateful that I haven't stopped thanking him for it, too. But as part of the story, and I can't talk without talking about my little boy, little Dan, bless his heart. He got a lot of stories about that kid, because he's neat. I got a picture in my wallet of the guy who came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he looks pretty bad, because you can see the hate and the hostility and the anger. And I got my new picture on my driver's license, and I looked at it and I said, oh my God, you really were bad. And I took it home and I showed it to Peggy, and she did, I said, you sure had a poor choice of a husband. You married that guy. I showed it to little Dan. And Dan looked at it and he said, oh, that's the Incredible Hulk. Dan and I talk, and he talks to me, and I talk to him, and we both share. And many times in the course of the week, Dan will say, hey, Dad, you going to go to a meeting? And I'll say, yeah. Why? He said, you just wanted to know. And he says, hey, Dad, you going to go to a meeting tonight? And I said, oh, I don't think so, Dan. He said, are you going to turn into the Incredible Hulk? No. The change. This is the little guy that used to run and hide from me. Just a few weeks ago for the very first time. Just a few weeks ago for the very first time. Peggy was out at an Al-Anon function, and Dan and I weren't doing anything. You watching television and talking and messing around, not paying any attention to anything, just doing nothing and having fun doing it. And out of the blue, just out of the blue, he said, Daddy, I love you. Now, where I came from, you don't do that. Because you get vulnerable in doing it. But there he was. He said it, and he meant it. And I was so choked up and my heart was so full. Because I didn't ask for it. He loves me because he wants to. For no other reason other than the fact that I'm just me. Dan was born with several defects. He has learning disabilities. He has a speech impediment. His visual problems. Exactly what the nature of his disabilities are, I'm certainly no expert, but I know he had serious trouble being able to orient himself in relation with other people, other places, himself in relation to anything else. I know that he had a mental problem that required medication, and the doctor said that he would probably have to have this the rest of his life, and it was no big deal. He had a problem whenever he tried to concentrate, his brain would go hyperactive and he couldn't do it. And it was an increasing source of frustration to him. Well, we don't all start even on this program. And I had been in it for a number of months and things were happening in my life. And Peggy and I, she just came in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she came even with me, at least almost even. We are ready to take our third step together. And this is how it works in my life. This is just one incident of which I can talk about for I don't know how long. Because I've never had anybody I made sit long enough to hear them all. But remember, you can't leave now. But we took our third step together. And this is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the God of my understanding. Because Peggy and I, our daughter, who was in Alateen, and little Dan, my dear friend and his wife, took a day out and we went to the Santa Cruz Mountains. Because we're looking for the setting. Something that just made us feel good and warm inside. Not that God's just up there. God's with you wherever you go. But we were looking for the setting that make it something a big deal. Because that's what we believe the third step is. It's a big deal. It is a total commitment. And I'm only going to do it once. And being an alcoholic, I wanted to do it right. So we all went up to the mountains. We had a beautiful picnic. And on the way back, we were looking and we found a little glen, a little clearing in the forest. And we stopped the car. And we all got out. And Bob and his wife sat on a log. And Peggy and I and Jackie and Daniel stood in a circle and held hands. And then we all kneeled. And Peggy turned her will and her life over to the care of God if she understood him. And Jackie turned her will and her life over to the care of God as she understood him. And then I turned my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him. And little Dan tugged at his mother's arm and he said, "Mommy, would you do it for me?" Now, Peggy turned his life over to the care of God. Because his will is his business. We were free to do that, and we did that. Now, it was quite a day in our life. One of many, many days. But you see, I offered a prayer when I first got sober. I said, "Hey, God, when you got these things going on, let me see them. And I want to know about them, and I want to be able to give thanks for them." Because it was just 2 weeks later, Prox, Peggy got a call from the school. See, Daniel's been going to this disability or learning disability class. And it was the disability, learning disability teacher that called Peggy. And she said, "Mrs. Carney, would you come on down? We'd like to talk about Daniel." And so Peggy went down. And teacher said, "Well, we don't know what's really happened here, but it seems as if his learning disabilities have disappeared. And there's no explanation for that one. And so he no longer needs his special class." And we smiled and said, "Isn't that nice that we should be this lucky?" And so Peggy took him to the doctor. And the doctor, he examined him. And the doctor said, "Well, Mrs. Carney, I guess it's called a spontaneous remission. Because these things are no longer there. And he no longer will need any medication." We said, "Thank you very kindly for that. Now I can go on with a story of a little guy. Because he's near and dear to me. I could go on forever, I swear. With just that phase of it. And I wouldn't scratch. I wouldn't begin to stand up and give testimonial to all of the things that have happened in my life. And give credit where credit is due. And credit is due to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You glorious people who gave me the book and the steps. You let me come back when I hated you." And some of you even come here tonight. And let me compete with the Easter Bunny. And you see, that's neat too. Because if you stop to realize, if you came from where I came from, where the world is a shitty place and everybody it is a bastard, and you hated everybody and everything, and you knew full well there was no meaning to anything in life, and you have publicly announced that you are going to talk someplace,
and people come, if you don't think that is a testimonial to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, then by God, I suggest that you read the book again. Because this is another one of those things that I get to see, I get to recognize, and I give thanks for. And I'd like to thank you all very much for listening so very nice. Good night.